One thing we notice in the Merkava text, or at least one of the Merkava texts, is the Alai L'Shabeach, the personal aspect of the focus of this prayer, as opposed to Aleinu. This is a great example to me of something I wouldn't have noticed that unless I saw another text that said it differently. Mm-hmm. Right? There's nothing strange about the plural. In fact, there's a rule that you have to pray in the plural, at least as it relates to the Amida. So, which goes so far as to change verses in the Torah, like the prayer for healing is Rifa'enu Adonai v'nei rafe, which is a quote from Jeremiah, which Jeremiah says Rifa'eni Adonai v'ei rafe. It's in the singular. So the Gemara already asks why it says it in the plural, not the singular, and the answer is because we have to pray in the plural. So as a term that refers to us in the plural doesn't stand out at all. But now I see a lie, and I'm like, oh, what? Why is it Aleinu, or why is it a lie? And we'll look at the context of that, but just to say, what would it mean if Aleinu, a lie, was a personal prayer as opposed to a communal prayer? How would that change the experience of it? Okay.
Is this a prayer? It does not have the prayer formula. It does not have a Khatimah. What is it? It's a strange animal.
Okay. So there is a Khatimah in the Merkava version, which is even stranger, right? Let's just look at that for 1 second. Flip over to page 2. Baruch atah Adonai, Adir, either Bechadre Shira or probably Bechadre Shira. Adir, who is like Adir Adirenu, great or magnified or one of those praise words, Bechadre Shira, with glory of song. Now, this is a strange bracha for two reasons. One, we've never heard it before, and that's not unusual because there's a lot of things we haven't heard of, but we know there's a rule that you can't write a bracha after the close of the Talmud. And you know who told us that rule? The Babylonian Gaonim, who also schmeissed the Eretz Yisrael liturgy and sent it into the Geniza for 1,000 years. So they're really into the, like, we've got some rules here. So once I see a bracha that doesn't show up in the Talmud, I've never heard of it before, then I'm starting to scratch my head. And you're saying, but the Aleinu that we have doesn't seem like a prayer because it doesn't have a bracha. I mean, the only thing worse than having no bracha is having this weird bracha. But it seems like a non-standard prayer because it doesn't have the Baruch Atah formula to it. And this also gets to the question of what is its original locus in the prayer book, which is not in the daily prayer, but in the Machzor on Rosh Hashanah, Musaf Rosh Hashanah, the only Amida with 9 brachot, is the first three, last three are always the same, and then the middle three are,
you remember? Zichronot,
Malchiyot. Yeah, Malchiyot, Zichronot, Shofarot, and then there's also Kedushat Hayom, this already debated in the Mishnah. There should be 10 brachot, and Beit Shammai did have 10 brachot, but it seems like Beit Hillel combined them into 9, so you got the Malchiyot plus Kedushat Hayom into one very long Chatimah, which seems like a mushed up Chatimah, which it is. But Aleinu is just an introduction to the center of Malchiyot. What is the center of Malchiyot, Zichron, and Shofarot? It is the verses, right? Already the Mishnah and the Tosefta explain that the center of Musaf on Rosh Hashanah are the 10 verses that you need for each of the themes. 3 from Torah, 3 from Ketuvim, which is really Tehillim, and 3 from Nevi'im, and then 1 more from Torah. And for Malchiyot, that's a problem, right? Because 3 from Torah, where is God called king in the Torah? Well, there's one that we say every day in Shirat Hayam, the best one, Adonai Imloch Le'olam Ba'ed. That's one. Now, the only problem is God is never really called king in the Torah besides for that. So they kind of sidestep it and they say, well, how about this one from Bilam's prophecy? Adonai will have imo utruat melech bo, truat melech bo. Maybe the melech is referring to God. Maybe that's 2. We'll count it. And then vayibi shurun melech bitase frashayam at the end of Devarim. Well, that probably is talking about God. Maybe it's talking about Moshe. That's 3, and that's it. So you remember what the last one is, because you got to end with the Torah verse. It is Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. The only problem with that verse is, it's a lovely verse, if you all know it. The only problem is, it doesn't say the word melech. But if you ever noticed, I say Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. You say? Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto. So the melech of Malchuto is just ratifying what we know the rabbis understand that verse to be, which is Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. When I say Shema, I'm accepting the yoke of the kingship of God, and therefore that's the fourth Torah verse. What are the verses that we end our Aleinu with? Kakatu b'Torah Techa, Adonai Imloch Le'lamed. What's that? That's the first of our four Torah verses from Malchiyah. V'ne'emar, what's V'ne'emar introduce? Not Torah, but prophets, Navi, right? This is Zechariah. In prophets, we got a number of mentions of God as king. So it ends in a way that makes sense if you understand the original context, which is Elaine is just introducing the verses to Malchiyah. Okay? So it wouldn't end with a Chatima, it's going to end with those verses. And if you're on Rosh Hashanah, eventually you would get to the end of the Bracha, which Elaine is like the intro paragraph to, and then you got the Baruch Atah Hashem formula with God as king.
So that leads to my second follow-up question as to then why was this passage seen as being so important? They took it out from
Why do they take a bit? If let's have a vote. Let's do a popular vote on any passage from the Machzor. You get one vote. The passage you vote for, we will say it in every service forever at the end, and everyone will hear it. All hands up for Aleinu, right? It's like, I don't know. Okay, so we have to answer that question. Why did Aleinu get to be so popular such that it shows up in every service if it was just a sort of marginal introductory text to one section of Rosh Hashanah Musaf, which only makes sense, or Rosh Hashanah? Okay, good. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm going to answer that question, which is, it is the one thing where we have the big fancy bowing thing. So it has that, like, physicality that stands out.
Alright, so you're putting forward a theory, which is maybe the bowing rises up, just on the bowing front, because it's just fun. If you flip over to 10, page 10, which is the very last page in the packet, the second 10. It's not the real 10, it's just our 10. Alright? There's a custom in Volozhin, the very last box. I rarely get to this box.
Nice.
Volozhin, okay, on Simchat Torah, they would follow the custom of the Gra, of the Gaon of Vilna, Vilna Gaon, that when they got to Aleinu to open the Holy Ark, Mishtachavim v'noflim al paneim b'kriyahu v'yishachavaya kibur Rosh Hashanah v'yom HaKippurim. Meaning, nowadays, we don't fall prostrate when we say Aleinu, except for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But also there was this tradition to do it on Simchat Torah as well, because Simchat Torah / Shmini Atzeret was like another rerun of Yom Kippur. And it's like, yeah, I love it. Now, you know, there was a character in Jewish history who loved the prostration so much, just to follow up on your lead here, who loved the prostration so much that he introduced it, including Aleinu, into every time that it says Baruch Atah Hashem, instead of bowing like this. This is kind of like a, oh, come on. It's like, do you really mean, are you doing anything even? You know, okay. That's, yeah. Have you seen those guys? Have you seen these guys? They go like this. Or how about these guys who go like this? Have you seen those guys? So.
Yeah, we call them Muslims.
Yeah, that's right. And Christians. Avram ben Arambam, who's the son of the Rambam. You think you have your kids and your parents, the father was a rabbi. And like, it's like, are they going to stay for him or not? Anyways, don't name your kid first name son of my name. Avram ben Arambam. That's literally how he goes through life. Avram ben Arambam, the son of the Rambam, makes a ruling for his community, the Rambam's community, next generation, where he's like, you know what? I walked down the street to the Sufis and I saw that they really knew how to daven. And I would like to bring in some of their practices, including bowing, because they have kavana, and you know what we do? We talk during the chazara. And that's not really great. So he introduces these prostrations, including Aleinu. So now it's like, I'm not saying he's saying it in Mincha Amar, but at least he's saying it in Shacharit. Every day for Aleinu, every time you say, Vanachtu Korim Mishtachavim Modim, every weekday, they're down on the floor. And not only that, he does it for every time you bow in the Amida. He gets down on the floor instead of the Baruch Atah Hashem. And every time in Kaddish, where there's like a little bowing, you see people do this sometimes, he would get down on the floor. I once led an Avram ben Arambam mincha, a prostration mincha, and I'm going to give you some advice. If you ever lead a prostration mincha, you should stretch before you do it. Because it is so much body, is the calves, okay? It's so much in a row. So all this is to say that maybe it was the bowing that was like made it so interesting. Although we don't bow, but maybe we could bow. Anyways, you think you have problems in your pulpit. Avram ben Arambam, when he introduced these innovations, the board got very upset. Okay, we'll say more about that. Okay, other questions, yeah.
Couldn't you do without all of the problematic lines? I'm not exactly sure how they make the point. Couldn't you say, Aleinu l'shabbat l'dor, akol l'teku l'av yosei v'reshit v'anachnu kori? Like, what is it about what intervenes that actually explains why we're going to bow now?
Okay, good. So this is a helpful question also to make us understand what the word v'anachnu, how you would translate v'anachnu. We know in the last class you can't start a sentence with a conjunction, okay? So, but you can start the second half of a sentence with a conjunction. And the conjunction here, we typically translate vav as and, but really it's meant to be translated as but. Va'anachnu korim, but we bow down and prostrate to Melech Malachem. Hey, mishtachavim lahev avarik. They prostrate to nothingness, but we prostrate to the Melech Malachem. So you could cut out all the triple lines. I have a sub-question to your question, which is, anyways, you could cut out all the controversial lines, but only if you reinterpret the word vav as well.
Yeah.
You know, or take out the vav, okay? But another thing is, if you're going to take out the controversial lines, so why don't you just take them all out? Meaning, if the sentence that we're all upset about and that the censors were upset about is Shei Mishtachavim Lev Ovarik, they bow down to vapor and nothingness and pray to a God who doesn't save, but they don't do anything with the words of Shelo Asanu Kigoy Aratzov, Shelo Sam Chalkenu Gehemagor Alein Kachol Amonam, or like Lahavir Gilulim Mina Aretz. Gilulim, you know what Gilulim are? It's like a bad word for poop. Okay? That's what they're calling the idols. Like, say it to Israelis, okay? Lavir Gulina Aretz is a put down for Elilim. Okay? So you're calling my God like dung? Why wouldn't I cut that line? Okay, which gets us to the question of why did we cut the line that we cut? So you know why we cut it.
Elo
Yoshia? What's wrong with that? Elo Yoshia, by the way, just so we're very clear, here, let's just take a look. Where do these words come from? Page 6, flip over to page 6. Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah, I don't remember too much about him, but I do know one thing, preceded Jesus, right? By a long time. Chapter 45, verse 20. Umit palalim el lo Yoshia. They, whoever Yishael is railing against, bow down to they, meaning the idol worshippers, bow down to a God who is Lo Yoshia, who can save. So, and also the Hevel Varik, here, just flip back to page 5. Hevel Varik is also just like a biblical phrase that shows up also in Yishael long before Jesus. So what's the
gematria? Vav?
6.
200.
10.
100. Kuf. What do we got?
316. 316. 6. 300. 316. Yeshu. Okay? So they bow down to Yeshu, but I can't say Yeshu because it would be too explicit. So I'm going to just wink, wink it at you. And that worked until that Mishumad guy, you know, blew it for everybody, ran over to the Christian government, was like, do you know what the Jews mean when they say, Shei Mishachavim Lahev Avarik? They mean you. They mean you are bowing down to Jesus. Now, the best thing about this gematria problem, meaning it's not a problem, it's all good, until we just, once you get down the gematria train, it's hard to stop. So, for instance, just read a little bit further with me. Okay, so Hei Mishtachavim Lahev Avarik, they bow down, they prostrate to Hevel, which is nothingness, Varik, and Jesus equals nothingness, and bow down to a God who does not save, Yoshia, which now works even better. But remember, this is not written in medieval Christian Europe. This is written, like, in the time of the Talmud, meaning way before. How old it is another debate, but it's not in the Middle Ages. But now just read a little bit further. ואנחנו קוראים למשך ומדים לפני מלך מלכי המלכים, הקדוש ברוך הוא, שהוא נוטה שמיים ויוסד הארץ, ומושב יקרו בשמיים עם העל. What's מושב יקרו בשמיים עם העל mean? מושב is? Dwelling place or seat, right? The seating, okay. Who yoshev, yikaro, the moshav of his yakar. Yakar is? Yeah, your dearness, your value, your kavod. Bashamayim ima is in heaven above. Okay? What's the problem if you're in a gematria world of moshav yikaro? Yikaro happens to have the exact same letters as varik, and therefore has the same gematria. Oh. And so therefore, you just said, by your own rules, the seat of Jesus is in Shamayim Imal. So you actually have like a sub, like a reaction formation where later authorities are like, actually don't say Moshav Yikaro, but say Kisei Kvodo. Okay, so they like censor it based on the gematria read on it, which is kind of awesome. But then you have people who are like, don't do that. We've gotten too far. Let's keep it as is, okay? But all I'm saying is, if you start searching for gematria, then you could get into trouble. But just to say, by the way, you know, again, gematria, oh, that's for those irrational, medieval Jews. But let's just do one piece of gematria, which is definitely what it's meant to be, but we may or may not connect to it. Friday night, the poem, L'chado di likrat kala. Pnei Shabbat Nekabalah, okay, right? L'chado di likrat kala, pnei Shabbat Nekabalah. How many words are there in L'chado di likrat kala, pnei Shabbat Nekabalah?
Seven.
Do I like seven? Yeah, I like seven.
Yeah.
Why do I like seven? Shabbos, okay. Also, if I'm a Kabbalist, P.S., a Kabbalist wrote this prayer, so that guy was reading Kabbalah, Shlomo Alevi Alkabetz, right? Shlomo, how do we know Shlomo Alevi Alkabetz? He wrote his name in it. Yeah, you remember how it goes? Shamor v'zachor, likrat Shabbat, mikdash melech, Naari, that's Shlomo. Hitori, Hitori, lo tevoshi, yaminu smol, no, bayu limshisa, yaminu smol. Shlomo Alevi. What's the last verse of L'chado Di? Bo'i v'shalom. Is his name Shlomo Alevi or Shlomo Alevi B? Why would he write a poem that ends with a stanza? He knows how this works. You got eight stanzas. His name has eight letters to it. So it should have been an eight stanza poem. Why has he got a ninth stanza in there that's Bo'i v'shalom? Okay, hold that. L'chado di likrat kala p'nei Shabbat nekabalah. Seven. Seven is Shabbat. But also, if you're a Kabbalist, seven lower sefirot of the ten sefirot. All right. Now, how many letters?
26.
Oh! You know what 26 is in gematria? That's jackpot. That's gematria jackpot. Check it out. L'chado di likrat kala, before the comma, is 15. You can count the letters later. L'chado di likrat kala, 15 letters. Pnei Shabbat nekabalah, 11 letters. 15 plus 11 is 26. What is this?
Name of God.
Yud, hey, 11, vav. Hey, I'm not going to write it together. But you get what I'm saying? Yud hey plus vav hey. What are you doing when you say L'chado di likrat kala p'nei Shabbat nekabalah? Shamor v'zachor b'dibor echad hishmianu
el hamyuchad
Adonai echad ushmo echad. You know what you're doing? You are uniting, whether you know it or not, you are uniting God's name, combining the gematria of Yud hey plus vav hey. And why are there nine stanzas and not eight stanzas, which would have worked better with his name? Because with the refrain, how many times do you say L'chado di likrat kala p'nei Shabbat nekabalah? If you got nine stanzas and the refrain, which comes before and after,
ten times.
Do I like ten? Yes. I love ten. Did I just totally unite God's name, Hishmiyanu El Amuchad, through the ten sefirot? Did I just do that? I totally did. Do I believe in it? I don't know if I believe in it, but the Kabbalists totally believed in it. Do you like it? Why do you like L'chado Di? Because of the tune, the melody, I don't know what. You like it because you're uniting the name of God, and you're doing it, and the only way you can figure it out is through gematria, all right? And the Shema, and we can go through it all, but we won't. Let's just say that gematria, there's something to it. But don't go too far, otherwise Jesus' throne is in heaven. It's a big problem. Okay, that's it. So, So just one last word on this parentheses here. Shem Yishtachavim Lehevav Arig Uvin Palim El Yoshia. So when they censored it, they crossed out the line. But again, and Langer has shown this, in some of the Siddurim, it was just a blank space, or in some cooler versions, a space that had asterisks. So it's like, you know and I know what we're supposed to say, we just can't write it down, right? It's like a bad word, but we can't print it. And the censors got onto that, and so there was an edict in the Prussian government. This is not like in the 700s. This like actually happened. In the 1800s, there was a soldier from the Prussian government who's stationed in the synagogue. Do you ever think about, why do we sing Aleinu? Why do we sing Aleinu? If you sing Aleinu l'shaveach l'kol, the reason you sing Aleinu is so that that soldier can make sure that you're not sneaking in your Shehem Yishtachavim Lehev Avari, because it does not fit the melee. I'm going to stand here, and I'm going to make you sing this out loud, okay? And I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make sure you do it, and it's going to be the end of the services. No one's going to cheat. That's on the censorship line. Other things, yeah.
Well, not before we leave that topic, can you say a word or two about the reintegration of this line into contemporary?
Yeah. Okay, right. So let's just please that one more step. So first of all, we're like, I'm a little bit embarrassed about it. Okay, but at some point, call it the Crusades, right? In the Crusades, you know, again, pre-Vatican II, in the Crusades, I am anti-Christian. The Christians are killing me. And so this becomes a very popular prayer, and they just really go to town on the meaning of it. Here's the non-censored version of Aleinu, where they were like, you know what? Let's call a spade and really go to town on the Christians who are running the Crusades. The Corpus Christi College, 133. Okay, Aleinu l'shabach l'adonai kol, ha'tekedu l'etzer b'reshit. This is one of the oldest Siddurim that they have printed. Shelo asanu kigoyei ha'aratzot, velo sam chalkenu kichelkam, v'goralenu kigoralam, little variety here. Shem Yishtachavim Lehev Avarik Umipalim Lael Lo Yoshia. Now, Adam Afar Dam Mara. Adam, an acronym. Who are they bowing down to? A person, not a god. Adam, which is an acronym for dust, blood, Mara, bitterness, or one of those, you know, humors or medieval, like, body stuff. Basar srucha, rima, tmeim utmeot, mina'afim u'mina'afot. These are all, this is flesh and blood, okay? That's what I'm talking about. They die with their sins and their evil doing. Bluye afar, rikuve rima, umipalim la'el lo yoshia. So this is like a full-on attack, okay? Okay, we're going to town on the anti-Jesus language that they added to Aleinu.
Be really hard to put that to a melody.
It's true. And the Prussian guy would definitely figure it out. Even if he spaced out for like a couple seconds, it's so long. So why did this end up in our services? Why is this so resonant? So it's not totally clear, but how does it end up back in our Siddurim? So first of all, this line, Shem Yishtachavim Lehev Avarik Lael Hoshia, is obliterated from all Siddurim, like, across the board. It is the number one censored line. You cannot sneak it through. And so there are hundreds of years that pass by where Jews haven't said it, even though it's preserved in some texts and maybe in some memories. And in 20th century, when Jews come back to their land and they print Siddurim in a land that they are running and there's no censor, they start to add back Shem Yishtachavim Lehev Avarik. So it only appears, again, in like mid-20th century, Orthodox Siddurim are also embarrassed by this line, and they don't want to print it. But late 20th century, you got Art Scroll that's coming back with it. It's like, this is the original prayer. We're going to print the original thing, and no one can stop us. You've got Koren, which starts by doing it exactly like Art Scroll did, and then gets forced to put it in parentheses. But it's really only like a late 20th century thing that it comes back into, like, unrepentant.
So how long was it censored for?
It's 500 years. Yeah, I mean, it's already sent in some versions of the tour. Look at this. This is amazing. I love this. I remember I was like, the censors are really on it. They didn't only censor the prayer text, they also censored the halachic literature around the prayer text. So if you look in the Tur, right, the great work of halacha, who's the son of the Rosh, Yaakov ben Asher, he's 13th century, but this printing is later than him. He's instructing you how to say Alein L'Shabech. Ve'omer Alein L'Shabech, u'kishiyagia el, when you arrive at the phrase, kechol hamonam, ve'lo samanu k'mishpachot hamash, shalom sav chalkeinu kem, ve'gor aleinu kechol hamonam, our lot, like kol hamonam, like everybody else, our lot is not assigned like them. When you arrive at that, yafsik mat kodem she'omar va'anu korim mishtachavim. You should pause a little bit before you say, but we bow down. Kadesh shelo yehei near F, flip to page 8. Ki'ilu chozer lamala. So you're making sure you don't reference what came before it. And there are those who say, ki sei kvodo, instead of moshavi karo, b'shamayim yimah. Ve'ein lomar kein, ela u'moshavi karo. Keinu anusach b'sefer echalot. So what he's saying is, pause a little bit, stop a little bit, kechol amonam, so that you don't say, v'anachnu korim mishtachavim modim, and think that you're referring back to kechol amonam, like all the people. The only problem is, that doesn't make any sense. The original text of the Tur, which I brought to you in the Hebrew right afterwards here, v'omer alin l'shabech, u'kishiyagia le'el lo yoshia. That's yafsik me'at. You should pause when you say, she'em mishtachavim u'mipalim el lo yoshia, pause, v'anachnu korim mishtachavim l'me'at, as opposed to v'anachnu. Like, we also bow down to the el lo yoshia. No, that would be bad, so pause a little bit. But you see, they censored the Tur. Incredible. They were, like, so on the ball, okay? So we're reading the Tur, it's like, yeah, whatever. And then it's like, no. They were monkeying with the text. They, like, just completely ran through it. Okay, so why? Why are we saying Aleinu, and why are they bringing back Shem Yishtachavim with like, we weren't saying this. Why? So I don't know, but I want to bring one text, which is difficult, but I think it's helpful to understand what Aleinu is about, at least as it comes to mean. It comes to mean. We're going to come back and see what it might have meant in the time of the Echalot, what it might have meant in other contexts. But in the time of the Jewish-Christian, you know, real difficult era, it is the song of the martyrs. Aleinu is the prayer that is recited when Jews are martyred in the Crusades. So this is, if you want if you want a rough job, you should be the scholar who collects all of the testimonies of the Crusades and publishes them. This is what Avram Haberman did, and he publishes this account of a Crusade massacre in 1171 in France, and he is printing their sort of eyewitness account of these people who are burned by the Crusaders. As the fire grew higher, they raised their voices in one voice. This is people who are locked in a tower, burned by the Crusaders. At the beginning, the melody was soft, and by the end, it was a loud noise. The Crusaders came to us and said, "What is your song? We never heard a melody like this." I don't know if it's our melody or some other melody, but apparently it had a melody, and it definitely had this line, "Shem Yishtachavim," as the melody. We all knew it was Aleinu L'Shabeach. V'yadanu b'yichud ki Aleinu L'Shabeach haya. So here you see a shift from what's the normal prayer of the martyrs, like Rabbi Akiva? Shema! Right? But in the Crusades, actually, Shema isn't strong enough. Right? Sheheim mishtachavim lahev avarik, and I know what varik means, u'mipalim alelo yoshia. That's what I'm going to say as you're burning me in the massacre, in the Crusade. And the description goes on, 32 holy souls sacrificed themselves as a mincha offering, intense imagery, to their creator. God smelled the pleasing smell that his chosen one offered to him. This gets into all the Crusade trope of, like, you think Avram was a big deal for sacrificing Isaac. Well, Isaac actually didn't get sacrificed, but I, the Crusader parent, am sacrificing my children, and I'm actually going through with it. So there's, like, a whole sort of world there. But you can see that Aleinu is sort of the last thing that leaves the lips of those who are dying. At least when I was growing up, Aleinu was a serious prayer. Like, you couldn't talk during Aleinu because it was the prayer that martyrs said, right? So there's something about, and especially like post-Holocaust, there's something about Aleinu and its sort of memory as it relates to the Middle Ages, where, you know, we could joke about the censorship and the gematria, but like, these were, the Jews really held on to this as a core sort of tenet in their fight against the power that was schmeissing them in the Crusades. I think part of the reason of the power of that prayer and why it moves out from obscurity of the introduction to Malchiot, which innocently, I think Malchiot is just innocently saying, like, they're idol worshippers. They bow down to nothing. If you look at the texts from the Tanakh, it's just talking about idol worshippers. They bow down to sticks and stones. They're like, they're not bowing down to real gods. But we are bowing down to Melech Malchei HaMelechim. And on Rosh Hashanah, we're going to make that god king. And then it gets moved into, you know, the crusader and the sort of martyr's song. Okay, that's on the censorship side. We good?
We saw the you had the phrase Ushkina Tuzo, and then you also had Betiferet Uzecha. Mm. Right, so you had these two spherotes connected to O's, you know, and we were just, what's that? You know, like it popped when we were looking for it.
Yeah, there are a lot of strange phrases. Just to note, let's just turn back to the first page for later. We just look at the text for a second. There's a lot of strange phrases in this prayer, which leads scholars to think that there actually is a Heichalot source to this prayer. For instance, calling God Yotzer Breshit. That's not, you said, like, this is not really a prayer. It doesn't have the formulas that we're used to.
It doesn't have God's name.
It doesn't have God's name.
It's normal God.
Correct. But Yotzer Breshit is referring to God, but that's not a normal way to refer to God, except if you're in Echalot. And then they sort of play around with that. And same with, like, what you're noticing, Ushchinat Uzo, like, that's also not a phrase that you find so often, or really at all, but now you're seeing it here. So there's something about the language of Aleinu that sort of does lead you to think that it comes... or it's somehow related to the Heichalot literature. Also, the reason we sing it also is because it has a rhythm to it, right? It has a meter to it. So you can put it to song. And that's also something that's characteristic of the Heichalot literature, because they wrote poems and poems and poems that were meant to be recited in a rhythm. So let's just take a look at the context of the Heichalot thing, because it's kind of wild.
Because also the repetitions.
That's right, the repetition. If you see... Adonai hu Elohim, Adonai Elohu Elohim, Adonai hu Elohim, hu echad, hu shmo echad, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai echad. You know, it's like, that's a mantra-type strategy where the way you get to the Heichal is not by, like, writing an essay or reading prose, it's by reciting a mantra, right? And so the mantric elements are sort of ramped up in this... in this version. By the way, where do we say Adonai Hu Elohim?
In Ne'ilah.
We say it in Ne'ilah, and we say it there how many times?
Seven.
Why? There's like a mantric element to that,
and that's
as well.
Why you do the
where does it come from? Where does it come from in the Bible?
Last week.
What was that? Haftarah last week. Yeah, what happened? Let's set it up. Baal versus Hashem.
Yeah.
Right? Baal, you guys have 400 priests, or maybe it's 450, and you're going to like... shout and yell, and you're going to cut yourselves, and how's that working? Why don't you scream a little bit louder, says Elijah, and still not working, and then Elijah's like, step aside, takes the water, dumps it on the sacrifice, dumps it again, and again, and again, and then he says, Aninu Adonai Aninu, which we also say on high holidays, right? Answer us, O Lord, answer us, and boom, down comes the fire, and then what does everybody else say? Adonai Elohim, which means, Adonai, hu Elohim. Oh, I get it. Yudevav he is Elohim, not Baal. Okay, that's the force of the Adonai. Adonai, hu Elohim. Oh, okay. So there's like that sort of recognition element. And also, I just had a personal revelatory experience that causes me to shout out Adonai, hu Elohim. It's literally an epiphany. Okay, so Adonai hu Elohim, we quoted from that scene from Elijah, but it's also a mantric element and follows an experience of God's presence. So let's look at the context of the Heichalot thing here. Because again, Heichalot, it's not just the text of the prayers, but also there's a background to it. This is just the line before Aleinu. Aleinu, as it appears in Heichalot, is preceded by the following short text. Okay? Amar Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael is having a conversation with Rabbi Akiva. Again, if you're a 19th century German scholar, it's Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva. But if you're a mystic, then it's Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva, like from the Mishnah. Okay? Rabbi Yishmael says to Rabbi Akiva, How are you able to look at the angels and see, Eich yachol litzpot bahen, bahen meaning the angels, velachzot ma'oseh, and now this is hechalot stuff, I love this stuff, rozai yud vav yud Elohei Yisrael. How are you able to see secret name of God, God of Israel? Okay, in other words, lo yirani adam b'chai. You can't see God and live. So Rabbi Yishmael says to Rabbi Akiva, much like in the Pardes, how did you see God? How did you pull that off? How'd you do it? So Rabbi Akiva says, I pray, here's how I did it. Tfilat rachamim hitpalalti. I prayed a prayer of mercy. Valide kachutzalti. And that prayer saved me, meaning I sort of got inoculated from the overwhelming, intense experience of seeing God. And I was able to do it. And then Rabbi Akiva describes what he saw. And Rabbi Akiva, kevan shit palalti atfila azo. Once I prayed this protective prayer, ra'iti shesh meod v'arba'im elef ribo malachei kavod shamdim k'negi k'sei kavod. I saw 640,000 angels of glory standing opposite the throne of glory. And, flip over the page, v'ra'iti tfilin shel, secret name of God, gidudei yud vav yud Elohei Yisrael, v'natati shevach al kol evarai alai l'shaber. What does Rabbi Akiva see? Kesher tefillin, hera le'anav, temunat adonai l'neged einav. This is kind of incredible, right? Kesher tefillin, you can't see my face, you won't live. But I'm going to pass by you and you can see my back. Well, what do you see? You think God isn't from? God isn't going to wear tefillin all day? Of course God's wearing tefillin all day. So you're Moshe, you see the back of God, i.e. kesher tefillin, the knot of the tefillin, as God is passing by. Right? God doesn't have a body except for all the places where God has a body. And of course God's going to wear tefillin. So that's what Rabbi Akiva sees. Ra'iti tefillin. I saw the tefillin of God. After I had that intense experience, personal revelatory experience with God, then I gave praise for all of my body, kol evarai, for all of my limbs, and the praise is alai l'shaber. So the alai is the me. Not us. We didn't see God. I saw God. I, Rabbi Akiva, I'm explaining to you, Rabbi Yishmael, but I saw God. And now the context of Aleinu, very, very different from the Middle Ages. The context of Aleinu is, it's the prayer I recite after I experience God's presence. And if you notice, not originally, not in the Machzor, but now, nowadays, right? When you say the Amida, after you say the Amida, you say Aleinu. That is to say, Aleinu can be seen as this prayer that follows the direct encounter with God, which is what the Amida is. And Mincha is probably the greatest example, right? Mincha, it's just like straight up Amida, Aleinu. You had the experience, you're coming down off the experience, and you're like Rabbi Akiva. Yeah.
Josh. I guess that it's a stretch, but given that this is happening in the context of Utsalti, any chance that that was also behind the reason why during the Masai Atzlav, they are also reciting Aleinu as a hope for Atzala?
Interesting. I mean, maybe. It seems like Rabbi Akiva is describing another prayer, which we don't have the text for, which he calls Tfilat Rachamim.
Correct.
That protects him, and then he recites Aleinu as a sheva, as a bakasha. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was surprised that you used the word epiphany next to Adonai Elohim. The way in which I understood it, actually, in this context, and I understood the last words of Taftara last week, thanks to this conversation, in this way, and so I'm surprised, it's like a story of success or an expression of success in front of Avodah Zarah or in front of the crusades that are coming to kill us, and we stand by our faith nonetheless.
I think in the context of the story of Eliyahu, it's Israel is the ones who are praying to Baal. it's not an external Baal like movement. It's like Israel themselves gets confused.
That's the thing in Yom Kippur, right? Like you're trying to, you know, to do Teshuvah from whatever you are, the Baal.
Yeah. I think we can extend this to the. This is what makes us nervous. We are not like Goyeha Aratzot. And God, you did not make us like Mishpechot Adama, like family of the land. Which, if you just take it like on its face, it sounds like we are different. We are special and different from the other people who are living in the land. Like, it's the least pluralistic text you could come up with, right? There's us and them. There's no real difference between us and them, except that they're them and we're us and we're different. But if you, again, if you look at the term as it shows up in the in Yechezkel, this is again railing against Israel for falling off the wagon for what they need to ask Kapara for, right?
Well, it might be a success against your Yetzer Hara or your inclination.
Good. So you can see it that way, and I think that's a good application. But just look at it in Yechezkel. Chapter 20. Now say to the house of Israel, this is God's from Yechezkel, thus says the Lord God, if you defile yourselves as your fathers did and go astray after their detestable things, and if to this very day you defile yourself in the presentation of your gifts by making your children pass through fire to all your fetishes, shall I respond to your inquiry, O house of Israel? In other words, is there something ipso facto by you being Israel? Do you think I'm going to answer your prayers regardless of how you're behaving? If you're sending your kids through the fire of Molech, you think just because you're Israel, I am going to answer you, says God? No, as I live, declares Lord God, I will not respond to you. Actually, this whole thing is dependent on your behavior, okay? If you start behaving like the idol worshiper, and here the idol worshiper isn't like the religion down the street. It's not like, oh, I went to the university chaplain, and he's like, here he's serving the Baal person, and here he's serving the Muslim. It's like, no, these are, the overlap between an idol worshiper and immorality was 100%. There's a reason why, in last week's Parsha, not only did they bow down to the calf, but then they got up litzachek. There was sexual boundaries that were being violated, okay? The behavior that's going on with an idol worshiper is not just, they're harmless, they bow down to sticks. No, there's something immoral about what's going on there. And you, Israel, are always tempted by them. And you're constantly following in their fetishes, right? I will not respond to you, says God. And what you have in mind shall never come to pass. Your tefillah will not be answered when you say, Niye kagoyim kemishpechot ha'aratzot lisharet eitz va'even. We say, you know what? God's with us no matter what. And we're going to be like everybody else who serves sticks and stones. But along with that comes putting your kid through the fire to Molech. Okay? So lo kemishpechot ha'adama doesn't need to mean all other people. It can mean the people who are immorally, like, who are adherents to an immoral religion where people sacrifice their children, okay? If that's not everybody in the land, fine, that's great. That's not what they're talking about here. They're not talking about, like, good, you know, non-Jews. They're talking about morally depraved people who associate their religion with violence towards other humans and their children, okay? And that's the Mishpechot HaAdama. It's not a neutral term. It's not like a geography. It's a set of ideals that and commitments that are the opposite of God. And you, Israel, keep getting tempted by them. And just because you're Israel doesn't mean I'm going to stick with you. You're going to suffer that. You are Mishpechot Adama. You keep forgetting. You keep slipping down that road. So when you say, I am not Mishpechot Adama, you can be sort of sticking, you know, your flag in the ground and saying, I will not be morally depraved. I will have some sort of values that is going to sort of, you know, be the definition of my religion, not simply my birthline or my ancestry. It has to be some sort of behavior, bless you, some sort of behavior that separates you from Mishpechot Adama. Otherwise, you just go down the slouching towards whatever, Gemara, like you're headed down towards Mishpechot HaRatzot, Kegoei HaRatzot, and that's a moral statement that you're putting a stand against, okay? Yeah.
Is there a comparable argument for below some volcanic ahem bagarle to fall on Hamonam? Because Hamonam feels a little less discriminate than that.
Less meaning it's everybody. It feels like it's, is that what you're saying?
Like it's harder for me to read that as being about a specific group of people that I'm not, who are immoral and trying to avoid.
I mean, mishpachot adama also seems pretty broad.
It does.
Right? So, but I'm saying once you take the meaning of that to indicate moral behavior, then I think mishpachot adama, kol amonam, it sounds really broad, but they're really talking about specific. It might have felt like Avram's on this side and everyone else is in the world against him. It might have felt like everybody was a morally depraved idol worshiper. Maybe it's not actually the case if they did like the demography, you know, like they did the surveys. But fundamentally, that's who their enemy is. Their enemy is a moral enemy, not a other people enemy. We could still quibble with the language and say, well, it sure sounds like other people. It sounds like everybody else. But what I'm telling you is in the context, again, it was us. We were the ones saying we want to be like Goyer Ratzon. We want to be like Mishpachot Adama. And so we're like moving into that category. And God's like, if you do that, you're going to get punished because you don't have a free pass just because you're Israel.
Again, I'm not saying that this is the intention. They don't. This is, how this is recited by Jews that feel chasing all over the world. At the end, it sticks. Because there's some combative language to this prayer. And it's voicing that. And that's why also it's problematic when you are Malchut. So when you are in the diaspora, okay, but then when you go and establish this language and you are Malchut, there's a moral question that is, I think, is, you know, it's pointing in the direction of those that are reciting the prayer.
For sure. There's, You can take this in the wrong direction, and if you have sovereignty, there could be some dangerous elements to this.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to recover is the aspect of the prayer, which is to say, I am trying to draw a line between my behavior. I'm doing two things. Number one, I am not the same as people who are morally depraved. I believe there's something called right and wrong, and I need to stand with right. And also, just because I'm Jewish, I'm not ipso facto in the right. Which would be two things that a sovereign nation run by Jews would do well to remember, I would say. Yeah.
Just to build on that point, in the Merkavah version, all the way on the right,
yeah.
Instead of the Goyer Ratzod and Mishpachot Adama, it says Darchei Rasha'im and Darchei Shaker, which aren't necessarily, I mean, it could be coded language, but it's not necessarily non-Jews or people that aren't like us, or it's people without the same moral code that we have.
Exactly. And I think that's a helpful way of looking at the prayer, where sometimes the prayer or the original prayer is quoting language in the Bible, but you don't get the language of the Bible unless you're reading the Bible on top of the prayer. But sometimes they're like, let me help you. Let's just spell it out for you. Anyone in favor of Darkei Rasha'im? All those in favor of Darkei Rasha'im, you're bothered by this prayer. But if I translate Mishpachot Adama as a synonym for Darkei Rasha'im, it's like, oh, that's what they're trying to tell me. They're trying to tell me that this is a group of people who are evildoers as opposed to a group of people who live over here, and I live over here. You know, that's a very different approach to understanding the prayer, and that's the tell. Sometimes these prayers that are about cursing the other, you know, naming our enemies, admitting that there are people out to kill us, to me, like in the 90s, felt like old-fashioned, you know? It's like the 90s didn't have people trying to kill us. I mean, they did, but whatever, okay? But it felt like they didn't. Okay, and the idea that there's like, well, you know, we're postmodern, and you know, is there really a right and a wrong and a capital right, and what about this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, actually, let's try this. There is a right and a wrong. There are people trying to kill us, and let's try to, I don't know, have some kavana in our prayers that acknowledges that without going off the deep end, without going completely crazy on the, like, you know, revenge and bloodthirst, etc., but some world in which, yeah, we have to say what's right and what's wrong. We have to stand with right. We have to say people are trying to kill us, and we have to hope for their neutralization, and that's also part of our prayer experience.